For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org. So, good morning. To especially welcome the people who are here for their first time, or even second time, or, you know, maybe especially, you know, also 200th time or whatever. But we're all here for the first time in some different ways. And my name is Nancy Easton, and I am giving the talk today because, as you can see, Tygon is not here, and I'm really, really happy to see so many young, old and new faces, I guess. I am going to be... I know that there were... I think Kathy told me that there were five, maybe, people in the...
Five or six, okay.
sitting Zazen for the first time. And so I'll be talking for a little bit, and then I'm hoping that we'll have a little bit of a discussion all together. Please feel welcome to ask questions about anything and your experience, or anything, you know, that just sort of strikes you about your experience today and coming here for the first time. What I'm specifically going to be talking about today is a topic that is really one of my favorites. It's the Bodhisattva precepts, and I'm going to be talking about what they are, what they mean, and how we can practice with them, and why we might want to practice with them. And I think knowing that I was going to be speaking today, and knowing how on Sundays we often do have many people who are here for the first time, I especially wanted to talk about something that is very fundamental to practice. You all came and you did Zazen, and that is certainly one thing that is fundamental to practice, and that is often, I think, the one thing that people, you know, maybe know about when they think about Zen or think about coming to a Buddhist temple, is they know that they're going to probably come and sit and meditate. And this is another aspect of practice that is also equally fundamental, but less maybe popularly known. The precepts are, I'll just describe them to start off, as sort of guidelines for how we interact with the world. And they're actually considered to be the gateway to authentic Zen practice. You know, we think of Zen, like I was saying, as being what you do on your cushion when you're sitting in meditation. And that is part of what Zen is. But, you know, another part of what Zen is about is how you bring that practice to your daily interactions with the world, because that's where we spend most of our lives, and where we, you know, where we can help to, you know, help the world and help situations. And so that, especially in Zen, where there is less of a focus on personal enlightenment and much more of a emphasis on all beings and all things enlightening together and awakening together, I think that's one reason why maybe the precepts are so important in Zen. They have a long tradition. We have our own particular, you know, sort of flavor of them, but actually the precepts go all the way back to the Buddha. Buddha taught about, I think, you know, he is sort of written down to have said that, you know, he teaches about suffering, its causes, and the conditions for the removal of suffering. And one of the key things that the Buddha taught about suffering is that it is caused by our greed, hatred, and delusion. We all have those qualities just as part of being a, you know, sort of a living mammal on the planet. It's just, it's hardwired into us. And the original precepts were proposed as a way to work with these. Buddha believed that there were sort of three inseparable elements to practice, actually. That there were sila, which is moral conduct, samadhi, which is concentration or meditation, or, you know, sort of zazen that you just did, and prajna, which is wisdom. And you cannot just focus on one. I think perhaps in the you know, like I'm saying, in the beginning of when Zen first came to the U.S., people were very focused on concentration and meditation and prajna, which is gaining wisdom. And actually, it's impossible to do any one of the three without all three being there. So sila is important, moral conduct. And moral conduct is really kind of a misleading term because... And that's what makes it hard to talk about the precepts before you really dive into it, because the precepts are not just moral or ethical rules or strictures. You know, they're not the Ten Commandments. They are actually they're the conditions of Buddha's mind. And by following them or learning to live in accord with them, we can realize Buddha's mind in our own lives. That, you know, we think of the word realize as like, you know, this bolt from the blue that comes to us and like, okay, suddenly I got it, you know. But actually, when you think about the word realize, it really means make real. And so you realize something by practicing it and making it real in your life. I had a thought that I'm not sure whether I want to include it now or later on in my talk. I'll see see if I can put it off. So we can think of the precepts as a means of letting go or working with our sort of small mind and allowing Buddha's mind to, or sort of the big mind to manifest. You know, we all are sort of hardwired to have our own small mind based on our own belief that we're separate, independent, individual beings, and it's not that that's not true. That is true, that we are, but we are also part of something larger, and our small minds that we, you know, live with on a day-to-day basis and that help us actually in many ways to live adaptively, you know, they kind of want things to be the way I want them to be. And and we tend to cut the world up into pieces. Actually, you know, there's like the subject, object, there's ourself and others. There are, you know, big, small, important, unimportant. It's, you know, I'm using sort of opposing examples as sort of, which sort of reflects that duality is that you hear people talk about. And in reality, things are really connected. You know, big mind is about unity and oneness, and the precepts help us live in accord with that. And I'll use an example of, you know, you maybe find yourself or found yourself or will one day find yourself sitting on your cushion and a thought will come up. That's okay, that happens. We don't try to prevent it, and actually it's helpful sometimes. And the thought might be about some really lousy thing that you said to someone earlier, or you know, some way in which, you know, perhaps you remember sort of, oh yeah, you know, I kind of hurt that person's feelings, or man, I was really angry, and you know, oh, I hope I didn't hurt that person's feelings. And it kind of, you know, it kind of disrupts your sort of peacefulness, you know, that we do things and then we experience, whether immediately or later, some amount of anxiety in response to those things. And I think, you know, actually what that kind of maybe shows us is that the self and others are not so separate. We're kind of suffering in a way because we are aware of, you know, some painful interaction that we had with someone else that's maybe making them suffer. So that's, you know, that's one example of where the precepts that we'll talk about in a little bit can be very helpful, because they, you know, we think that the way to end our own suffering is by getting what we want or not getting what we don't want, or having things go in a particular way and making sure that, you know, well, we're okay, taking care of ourselves. And, you know, that is at the heart of what Buddha was talking about as sort of the fundamental delusion, that, in fact, we often create more suffering for ourselves by clamoring after or reaching or grasping for what we want and trying to orchestrate things for ourselves. We actually... we actually help to reduce our own suffering by working to help to reduce the suffering of others. And we'll get into that. We'll get into that in a little bit. But one last sort of thing that I want to talk about is the concept of dependent co-arising, that everything is connected and depends on everything else. And it really is. You can see it on a lot of different levels in your life. You know, all kinds of beings and things helped get you here today, whether it was, you know, the CTA or, you know, somebody maybe, you know, cooked something that you ate or made coffee that you drank, or, you know, someone had to harvest the coffee beans. There's always something. And that's not exactly dependent co-arising, but it's maybe one aspect of it, that anytime we do anything, we are influencing everyone and everything around us. And everything around us is influencing us to come here. Something influenced everybody to come here today, you know, whether you know it or not. And that's there's so many things that influence us to do anything, that's kind of the idea of dependent co-arising, that it's really an endless sort of sum of conditions that go into that. And I think, you know, the precepts help us to wake up to that just as much as meditation or zazen, because they help us see very clearly, actually, in real life situations when we are operating under our fundamental delusion of being separate beings, and help us to slowly sort of relax that view a little bit or widen our view. So, to get more specific, in Zen we have actually 16 bodhisattva precepts. Some traditions, you know, that I'm familiar with, you'll hear about 5 in particular that come in some traditions. And long, long ago, when Buddha was living with a community of monks, I think he had some, you know, there were something like 250 precepts that monastic practitioners had to follow. We have 16, and they're divided into 3 groups or sections. There are the first 3 are called the 3 refuges, the second 3 are called the 3 pure precepts, and the last 10 are the 10 grave precepts. And I guess I always forget to announce the title of my talk at the beginning, but the title of my talk is actually Taking Refuge. And so I think, not because it's the title of my talk, but because of why we practice the precepts, I think it's maybe appropriate that it starts with taking refuge. And when you think about a refuge, refuge actually means, you know, to fly back or to come back to. We popularly think of refuge as being a shelter, and When we really set out to practice the precepts, we start by sort of taking shelter from our small-minded beliefs that actually are not working on some level. I think we probably, I hope we all can agree that they're not really working on some level, and we're helped by using the precepts to come back to big mind or Buddha's mind or the state in which things are one and are depending on each other. So the refuges are basically guides for us. And the first one is taking refuge in Buddha. The actual Buddha, the historical Buddha, as well as, but more than that, you also take refuge in things as they are. Yourself being the way you are, everything around you being as it is. You just sort of take some refuge in, okay, here's the situation. You know, it is what it is. We take refuge in Dharma, which is the teaching. So we talked about, you know, Dharma discussion, or Dharma is a word that people, I think, maybe know more these days. And it really means the teaching. And it also means, actually, in some ways everything. And it's sort of, I think the word reflects ways in which everything is teaching us. You know, the reality is what it is, and it is teaching us at the same time. And finally, we take refuge in Sangha, which are the people who practice with us or the people who support your practice, which is actually everyone. And in taking refuge in Sangha, we... you know, we try to help and support each other and also take some support from each other. And I think possibly if you have taken a class on Buddhism or if you're in a class right now, you will hear the word Tripitaka or Tripitaka, which is the Pali word, I think, for the three treasures or the three jewels. And that's what they mean. It's Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we take refuge in them. We take, you know, some comfort in them, and we work to try to uphold them and respect them. And so those are the three refuges in as the first part of the precepts. I think what I'm struggling with is there is actually quite a lot to say about all of these things and not a lot of time in which to say it. So it's hard sometimes to figure out what exactly I want to say, and maybe at the end I will... point out a couple of my favorite books on the precepts, and just to give you some reference. So unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to talk about any of these things in as much depth as I would like to. But the second group of precepts are called the three pure precepts. And actually, they evolved from an original teaching of Buddha, which said, abstain from all unwholesome deeds, perform wholesome deeds, purify your mind. This is the teaching of enlightened persons. So you abstain from all unwholesome deeds, purify wholesome ones, or perform wholesome ones, and purify your mind. You drop things that are not good, you cultivate things that are good, and you work to continue to purify your mind. And so the way that this has transformed in the Bodhisattva precepts is, the first one is embracing and sustaining forms and ceremonies. I vow to embrace and sustain forms and ceremonies, which actually corresponds to refraining from evil. It's restated more positively, but when we embrace and sustain forms and ceremonies, we add some discipline to our life. We are on, you know, we maybe come on time, we try to maintain mindfulness, we practice particular things, we really work to pay attention to our behavior and to refrain from just doing mindful, you know, evil deeds is maybe a little something that we can't relate to, because I think many of us don't set out to do evil deeds on any kind of daily basis, but we sometimes wind up inadvertently doing some evil deeds by virtue of being, not mindful. So we embrace and sustain forms and ceremonies as a way of helping ourselves orient toward, away from engaging in evil practices. The second one is embracing and sustaining all good. We would say, I vow to embrace and sustain all good. Seems pretty straightforward. And the third is embracing and sustaining all beings. This actually corresponds with what the third thing that the Buddha said about purifying your mind. You might think that embracing and sustaining in forms and ceremonies would purify your mind, and I think it probably has some of that quality, but in embracing and sustaining all beings, this is actually part of purifying your mind, because in Zen, our minds are purified by working for the benefit of others, and so we try to uphold and respect and support all beings. And so these are the three pure precepts, because they're actually purified of duality. They're ways in which when you really engage with them, you actually really begin to accord yourself in sort of an aspirational kind of way with a more, you know, kind of spacious, unified perspective. So now I'm going to move on to the 10 grave precepts, which I think tend to be what most people think of when they think of precepts. These are probably the most recognizable ones, and you have probably heard of them. And I'm just going to read through them the first time, and then I'll talk about them. First one is not killing. Second would be not taking what is not given, which is sometimes called stealing. Not misusing sexuality. Not lying or using false speech. Not intoxicating mind or body of self or other. Not speaking of the faults of others. Not praising self at the expense of others. Not being possessive of anything, especially the Dharma. Not harboring ill will. And not disparaging the triple treasure of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so I'm going to read through them again in a moment. They sound a little negative, you know. I think maybe for many Westerners who grew up in some form of Judeo-Christian tradition, this can really sound a lot like the Ten Commandments, like, you know, thou shalt not, starting with killing. And I think that's what maybe sometimes can be a little confusing and can sometimes seem like, okay, all right, you know, I'm not taking what is not given, check, you know, okay, not lying, check. You know, it's not really like that. And so I'm going to read them again, and I'm going to read them along with a maybe more positively stated version of this, which comes from actually... There are a number of versions of sort of restating the precepts in a more positive way that maybe helps you understand what to do rather than what not to do. The one that I read that I'm going to read to you is actually printed on it's framed actually back in our back hallway. It's called the Clear Mind Precept. So I'll read each of the 10 grave precepts along with its Clear Mind correspondent. And you can maybe hear a little bit of the difference. So the first would be, you know, not killing. A disciple of Buddha does not kill. And the clear mind correspondent would be cultivating and encouraging life. We can think about how we might, ways in which we might do that. Not taking what is not given versus honoring the gift not yet given. Not misusing sexuality versus remaining faithful in relationships. Not lying or using false speech, communicating truth. Not intoxicating mind or body of self or other, polishing clarity and dispelling delusion. Not speaking of the faults of others, creating wisdom from ignorance. Not praising self at the expense of others, would be maintaining modesty and maybe extolling others. Not being possessive of anything, especially the Dharma, would maybe correspond with sharing understanding freely, giving of self. Sharing understanding and freely giving of self. Not harboring ill will, dwelling in equanimity. Not disparaging the triple treasure, respecting the triple treasure of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay. So there are... It has been said that actually all of the grave precepts are based on the first precept of not killing. And I think that's one thing that I want to highlight today, because there are many ways to kill, and a disciple of Buddha does not kill. And I think probably for most of us, we have never killed anyone, don't have any plans to kill anyone, we'll probably never be in a situation where that would even come up for any reason. And so what we tend to think about when we think about not killing are usually two topics, vegetarianism and bugs. And those are good things. And they are worth consideration. But I think what I especially wanted to highlight is that there are many ways to kill without, you know, eating meat or squishing bugs. And there are actually very subtle ways of killing. And I think in paying, and the reason I want to talk about this is because actually I think in paying attention to the ways in which we maybe subtly kill something, it's really kind of points to how we can, you know, wake up in some ways. So I'll give you some examples. I think that we can sometimes, or at least I can, unthinkingly regard other people as objects. And I'll use my own real life example of getting on the L train at rush hour when, you know, there is an opening about this wide, there are about two seats, and there are about 17 people who are trying to get through there and get to the two seats. And I am really, really working hard with trying not to see those people as just obstacles to getting in my way. You know, it's like you're kind of there and you're just like, I really need that seat, and you are in my way, move it. And it kind of turns that person into a thing or into an object, you know? And it really kind of leaves aside any thought of, you know, the myriad causes and conditions that brought that other person to be on the L platform with you, or anything that's going on in their life, or any way in which, you know, they maybe are supporting you, you could be supporting them. You know, they just become sort of a, you know, move it. And it's whatever you do with that, I think, you know, is your own business, and I'm not going to get into that. But I think there is, you know, I think there's value in working with that impulse. At least I continue to find value in working with that impulse of not like, you know, bad girl, you pushed somebody out of the way to get that seat, but more kind of looking at, you know, what am I doing? What am I doing here? How am I, you know, is this really helping me? Am I really, when I get that seat, am I going to sit there and feel really guilty about the person that I just elbowed out of the way? I mean, this is a crude, you know, kind of example, but it's a, I think the reason I wanted to bring it up is it is so, you know, basic. And my own, I might get a seat, but I might continue to suffer because of the way in which I went about getting that seat. So it kind of speaks to the way in which, you know, getting our own way does not necessarily bring happiness, and working for, you know, sort of a sustainable benefit of others is something that really does bring a little bit more peace of mind. It brings a little bit more harmony to the world. So that's one. I think, you know, we can all come up with different examples. Like, people who drive have a lot of examples of traffic, but this is mine. Another way in which we can actually kill is by regarding even things and resources as objects to exploit. You know, oil, for instance, it supports our life, and it's a thing, you know? Okay, so, like, what's the problem? It's a thing, you know? Use it. We use it. But I think what the problem is when we use it wastefully or not thinking about the ways in which we, you know, we're doing things that are ultimately going to harm, you know, not just ourselves, but others, you know, the whole planet, possibly the whole future. And so it's not that it's bad to drive a car or anything like that. I think, you know, practicing with the idea of the world being alive, you know, and things are not just things for us to do what we want with. We have to, it maybe helps us to develop a little bit more sense of respect with the world as a whole, and helps us feel a little bit less separate. We think about, you know, we think that there's a whole world out there, and that there's a little something extra, which is me. You know, there's me, and then there's the world. And actually, it's not really like that. We're actually really a part of the world, and need to. That's so, you know, it sounds kind of moral, but I think it's possible to find a little bit more peace for ourselves and for others by working in harmony with the world. And so my last example is in involves developing fixed ideas of others. And this comes from directly from one of the books that I'll tell you about, which is called Waking Up to What You Do by Diane Eshin Rosetto, who is a... She's a Dharma teacher in California, and she wrote a book about the precepts that is a little less literal. It doesn't follow the way that I'm describing them here, but she has one idea in here really, really appeals to me. She talks about a couple of, you know, more positive practices that, you know, that involve speaking of others with openness and possibility and meeting others on equal ground. There's a way in which we can think about, you know, somebody in our life that we interact with on a daily basis, and we start to develop an idea about that person, you know, that maybe it's a positive idea, but maybe it's a negative idea, like, you know, that person is kind of unreliable. And then we start sort of subtly, you know, behaving towards that person in kind of a demeaning kind of way, or maybe we just, you know, withhold from that person. And it actually kind of kills the possibility of things changing. You know, if we are all about waking up and all about, you know, kind of awakening together, then deciding that a person is, you know, reliable and can't be trusted is really kind of a fixed view. Even if you've had a fair amount of evidence that that's true, A different way to work with that might be to continue to notice that, you know, maybe a particular interaction goes south with fairly frequently, but to study that, you know, and to study, you know, what's my part in this, what's happening, and that's where, you know, that's where I think some of the, you know, maybe prajna or wisdom comes in to working with the precepts, is because as we you know, sit zazen and meditate and practice that way, and as we practice with observing, you know, what we do in the world, you know, studying the self, we gain some wisdom about situations, which helps us to maybe respond more skillfully. And which helps actually to you know, maybe restore a little bit of life to relationships with people that have gone stale. The relationships, I mean, not so much the people. You know, I want to say that it's important, I think, to acknowledge what's happening, but to speak in a way that does not turn a person or, you know, a thing or a situation into, you know, something fixed. You know, I think we heard a lot about evildoers in, you know, the years between 2001 and 2008. And, you know, it's so much more complex than that. There is, even in people that we don't like or that are maybe causing us pain, they are, you know, I think it's maybe important to remember that they really are responding from their own pain, you know, or their own conditions, or they don't even intend to cause us pain. But something, you know, something's happening that's more than, much more complicated and actually kind of lively than just, you know, you're bad. So I'm kind of wanting to wrap up, and I think the last thing that I want to you know, really acknowledge with the precepts before we kind of have a discussion is that we cannot do this perfectly. You know, you just can't. We live in an imperfect, you know, dimensional, relative world. We are separate beings in some important ways, but and the Buddha's mind is, you know, really it's absolute, and it's a matter of trying to become more skillful with finding ways to bridge that gap between, you know, knowing that we really are all connected and noticing all the ways in which disconnection happens. You know, we can become actually more connected by noticing the ways that we are disconnected, and it's actually also been said that it's maybe most, you're most clearly practicing the precepts when you realize that you have broken one, because you're, you know, you're kind of at least aware in that moment. Because actually we're always breaking them on some level. And when you really delve into studying each one, which, you know, unfortunately I can't even really get into much with that in the scope of a talk. But you really start to notice, okay, you know, here's what I'm doing. And so I want to emphasize that this is a practice and a process, and it really bears fruit. It bears fruit along the way, and it responds to our effort. You know, it's I think maybe more proof of non-duality that as we come to, you know, sort of study the precepts more and practice them more and engage with them more, they really, you know, kind of come to life a little bit more in our lives, and that you really are rewarded with actually quite a lot of, you know, knowledge or you know, at least some rich sort of awareness about what you're doing. And so, I'll just tell you about two really great books that if you are interested in learning more about this would be great to read. And the first one is the one that I was telling you before, Waking Up to What You Do. But actually my favorite book on the precepts is Being Upright, and it is by Reb Anderson, who was here. He is a long, long time abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, which we are a part of that lineage. And he came here in April, and for our temple dedication weekend, and give some talks about living more compassionately, living for the welfare of the world, and he wrote this really great book on the precepts that really brings them to life in a way that is, you know, really, really more than just being about the Ten Commandments. You know, I think one of the things that he said here and certainly conveys in the book is the way in which, you know, we really do find the end of suffering for ourselves by working for the end of suffering in others.